Awesome, like podcasts and stuff?
I've seen people with podcasts less desperate for approval.
I hope this isn't about your podcast again.
Please, podcasts are verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
What's up, everybody? Welcome in. It is episode 18 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. It is presented by Clip It. There's no better way to share your favorite clips with friends and family, or hell, even frenemies as well. You can download the Clip It app today, available on iOS and on Android. Ben Heisler with you. We are getting set for this year's U.S. Open from Shinnecock Hills in New York, and we wanted to speak with somebody who is going to be a part of the action on Fox and FS1, Shane Bacon, the broadcaster for Fox and FS1. He'll share the play-by-play duties with Joe Buck. He'll join us in just a moment. Shane's name and voice have been synonymous with golf for many years. He's also flown up the rankings into a star over at Fox's USGA coverage. He shared some stories from when he was a caddy over at St. Andrews in Scotland after college, discussed his rise into television, and of course, the excitement just that it's brewing. It's palpable over Tiger Woods, being a legit competitor in this year's field. But before we do that, we like to make the show interactive and give you guys a chance to win $50 to Amazon courtesy of our friends over at Clip It. Be following us on Twitter at Awful Announcing. We'll drop hints on who our next podcast guest will be. If you're the first one to correctly identify the guest, we'll bring you on and you have a chance to win. And today we are joined by Phil in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Phil, it's good to talk to you. How are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being a part of it. Do you know how the game is played?
Yes, sir.
Well, for those that don't know how the game is played, Phil in Winston-Salem is going to get a couple clips courtesy from our friends over at Clip It. If he gets both of them right and identifies them, he will win $50 to Amazon.com. If he does not get both of them right, only gets one, it'll be $25. If he gets zero rights, he does not win anything. All right, Phil, the first clip comes from recent coverage of the NBA Finals, where LeBron James and this reporter from ESPN did not seem to get off to a real good start. I want you to tell me the name of this reporter when I play it for you coming up right here.
Describe what was in your mind both tonight and last year when Kevin Durant launched that shot from the wing.
I actually think you should be like a psychiatrist. You want to just keep trying to get in somebody's mind. That's the whole thing, huh, Mark? What's in my mind, miss it so we can get the rebound.
Did it feel like last year to you? Did you think of it at that moment?
No.
All right, any ideas on who that first person was?
Mark Schwartz.
It was Mark Schwartz. Nicely done. That is $25 to Amazon in your name. Congratulations. We'll move on to clip number two. Moments after the Warriors swept the Cavaliers, I need you to tell me this reporter from ESPN who broke some substantial news regarding one LeBron James.
LeBron James has been playing the last three games with a serious right hand injury that he suffered after punching a blackboard in the locker room in Golden State following game one. He's had to have two MRIs on the hand. He's been in a soft cast when he's been away from the media and away from practice. Hasn't been practicing.
All right, Phil, this guy's been around LeBron James for an awfully long time. Can you tell me that reporter?
Brian Windhorst.
It was Brian Windhorst. Nicely done. You made that very easy. $50 to Amazon.com is yours, courtesy of our friends over at Clip It. Phil, stay cool over in Winston-Salem. Thank you so much for following us on Twitter and for playing in the Awful Announcing Podcast game. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks so much.
Congratulations to Phil in Winston-Salem. He gets $50 to Amazon.com. Remember, all you have to do is follow us on Twitter at Awful Announcing. We will post out hints for who our guest will be. And if you're the first one to correctly identify it, you have a chance to win and play for $50 to Amazon.com. The way that I see it is those are $50 that you didn't have before, so you might as well follow us and have a chance to play. Excited to talk to Shane Bacon, the host and play-by-play announcer for Fox Sports' coverage of the USGA Championships. You can hear and watch him this week during Fox and FS1's broadcast from the 2018 U.S. Open from Shinnecock Hills Golf Club in New York. He's also the host of the Clubhouse podcast. He's on Twitter as well, at Shane Bacon. Shane, thanks so much for the time, man. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Just sitting in our trailer here at Shinnecock Hills. I was out on the course a little bit ago watching Rory McIlroy and Jon Rahm and one of the amateurs kind of, you know, go around a few holes, just chatting with them a bit. And I mean, you know, all the players, I think, are really, really excited. It's funny. The players get really fired up when they get to go to these kind of historic-y U.S. Open courses. For us, that makes it a lot better.
I would imagine. So I'll get to the course and I'll get to sort of your perspective on the field and the conditions going in just a little bit. But I want to start at your younger age, because I feel like everybody has a good caddying story. And you got to caddy at one of the greatest golf courses and one of the most historic golf courses in the world at St. Andrews in Scotland. So there must have been some amazing personalities and situations that you got to be a part of and that you got to experience. Any you can share with us?
Yeah. So I got out of college in 06 from the University of Arizona, and a buddy of mine, he actually caddied at Estancia in North Scottsdale, which is one of the best courses in Arizona, very private desert course. One of the caddy friends of his there worked at St. Andrews in the summer there, and then he'd come over to Phoenix and work here. So the guy's like, yeah, just come over. You'll get jobs. And we were like, sure, that sounds like a great idea. And then, so we flew over there without any idea what we were going to be doing. And met with a caddy master, and he's talking about how serious the gig is. You know, this is the old course, the oldest course in the world. And he's like, by the way, you guys are on the tee in 30 minutes. And my friend Will had never seen the golf course before. So we're in the same group, and I luckily got a chance to play it when I was studying abroad. So, you know, we're both kind of like leaning on these yardage books. But I would say maybe the funniest or weirdest thing I saw, if anybody's ever played the old course, 7 and 11, it's this wacky crisscross design that would never, you know, work in today's game. Nobody would ever be able to get away with this. But you hit 7 out to the left, and then you cross over where the people from 11 are walking up, and it's the same green. It's just kind of a cluster. And one of my guys just smoke hooks this ball on 7 right at these guys putting on 11. And so we're screaming 4. I mean, as loud as we can scream it. And the guys, it's pretty windy. And, you know, when the wind's blowing into you, you know, the sound just doesn't travel as well. And it just absolutely pelts this guy in the back, like on the fly. And the guy barely moved. He barely moved at all. And he ended up holing like the 5-footer. And then he kind of turned around to hit him in the back. And I was like, man, I am not messing with that guy. That must be like the toughest dude out of the golf course right now.
No kidding. I mean, that's pretty impressive that he didn't even move, just sat down, knocked it out afterwards. I mean, did you pick up during the time? Did you pick up any of the accents in Scotland? Like, how long were you there for?
Yeah, we were over there for, I think we caddied for a total of about four and a half months. You know, it was kind of one of those, you know, we got out of college, we didn't know what we were going to do. We went over there, just kind of picked up gigs, and then we started to make, you know, you make cash and you make pretty good money, and we caddied 2 loops a day. So, you know, we'd have a whole bunch of money set aside, we had all these, you know, British pounds set aside. We had all this money. We lived with a Scottish lady. We shared a room for £40 a week each, and then for 5 more pounds she'd do our laundry. So it cost us £45 a week, and that's how you paid. I mean, your rent was paid by the week, and she's the nicest lady ever. And you know, we'd make that one loop. So I mean, we'd do one loop that'd pay for our rent, and then after that it was all kind of a profit. So it was awesome. I mean, you know, it was one of those things, you know, looking back on it, you know, when there's certain things you do in your youth that you're really, really proud of. Trust me, there's plenty of things I did in my youth that I'm not proud of. But That was one of those things that looking back, you know, when we tell people we got a chance to do that, it's a pretty cool thing to be proud of.
Do you remember the first time that you ever got a chance to play your first 9 or your first 18 holes? And was there something that stuck with you from the very first time you played that sort of established in your mind that you wanted to make it a career?
I mean, golf wise, you know, I was always kind of I always played everything else. I mean, I played a pretty competitive baseball, and I was a big basketball player, and I tried to play football, but I was too small for football. So they ended up after 8th grade, they said, you know, you're going to get killed out here if you keep doing this. So it was kind of around then, really, for me. I mean, I played a little bit. My dad was a big golfer. But right around kind of, you know, 8th, 9th grade, you know, I started to play a little bit more. And I started to get a little bit better. And then I started to play in some competitive junior tournaments and stuff like that. And it was kind of transition into high school where, you know, it was like, are you going to play baseball or golf? Because it's the same season. And that was kind of it for me. I mean, I mean, my dad and I would go out and play all the time. And, you know, it was kind of a fun thing for us to share because he kind of quit playing a lot. He used to play all the time. And he kind of quit playing when we were kind of coming up because he wanted to, you know, use his time to kind of raise his kids. So I think, you know, when I finally kind of got the golf bug, it was cool for him to have somebody to go out there and pal around with on the golf course. So, you know, that was always the fun part for me was golf's always been something that I've been able to kind of do with my dad. And so, you know, he turned 70 next January, and I'm already like working on like, what are we going to go do for your 70th birthday golf trip wise? And he doesn't play that much golf anymore, but when we go on these trips, you know, he'll still go out there and bust 36 holes out a day. So I think that was kind of the passion. That's where it kind of started to light inside of me was just knowing that this was kind of an affair that you can do, not just, you know, with my dad, but, you know, I mean, maybe with my, you know, with my kids and stuff like that. I think it's a rare thing competitive thing that you get to do, you know, through generations. And I think that's something that makes it so special. So I think that was kind of the initial idea with me, was it was just something I knew I could do with my dad forever.
I love that, because I think it's a very universal component to so many kids that are starting off golf. You want it to be something either within your family, or you have friends, or eventually you join a part of a team. There's a family and community element to the game of golf.
You know, it's you know, I always say it's such an intimidating thing to pick up, because, you know, for me, like with my friends, you know, I always say, you know, there's all these initiatives to kind of build and grow the game. And I always say, just wait till people turn 30, you know, because when they turn 30, they start playing golf. And, you know, I have some friends that have recently picked it up over the last 2 or 3 years. And, you know, you can just see, you know, the want to get better so quick. And you just know how hard this game is. I mean, I understand the uphill battle it is, but, you know, people stick with it. I mean, I see some friends improving. What I think is so cool is when I get to see pals of mine take that next step. So if the next step's maybe, you know, going from, you know, shooting 100 to going to shoot 90, or even if it's from going to shoot 85 to shooting in the 70s fairly consistently, you know, I love to see that step. And to see what happened to do it, you know, was it understanding the game better? Was it managing the course better? Was it just working on your short game a little bit more? I think that's kind of fun for me to see through their eyes, because, you know, it's been something I've been playing for quite a while, and watch their struggle with it as well, because I like to see when they get better at it.
And golf is fascinating in the sense, too, that you're playing on the same courses of the greatest golfers in the world. And so I think for a lot of people, especially novices, I'd say they're going to go pick up golf, that there's sort of this element in their mind that, well, if I'm playing on the same course and this guy's playing on the same course, I can learn how to do this. Like, you're not playing pickup basketball in Allen Fieldhouse, where University of Kansas is, or the United Center, where the Bulls play. There's a sort of a community aspect of saying that I'm playing on the same tees and using the same clubs as these guys, I should be able to pick it up. But it's so much harder than that. And I feel like that's why a lot of people, they'll give it up, because they think it's supposed to be a lot easier than it really is. And I think a lot of professional golfers probably get a kick out of that too.
They sure make it easy. I mean, you know, when you're, like I said, I was out there watching Rory and John Rahm, and, you know, they're just kind of, you know, they're just trying to get a feel for the golf course, and they're hitting golf shots here and there. And I'll tell you, they make it look, you know, so simple. It would frustrate you out there and watch the tournament. Why can't I do that? And you're like, well, I mean, you know, this is their craft. I mean, they've mastered their craft. I mean, most people that do that, the 50 best painters in the world, they're going to be way better than you if you're just recreationally doing it. So, yeah, it's a fun sport to be a part of. And, I mean, I just love that, you know, it's something, like I said, you know, my friends, you know, I'm 34, and my friends have really kind of attached themselves to it, and they're passionate about it now. And, you know, you don't see that. You don't see guys that are just taking up baseball when they're 32, or just taking up, you know, softball or football when they're 32. You know, normally, you know, that's something that it's kind of passed and by. And with golf, you can just start doing it when you're 40, 50, 60 years old.
Well, someone who's just turned 30, the element of trying to pick it up again at the age of 30 is actually ringing very true to me. So I appreciate that's more of a universal element, more so than I thought. One thing that I was curious to get your perspective on is before the Masters, I had Nota Begay on this podcast, and I asked him if he thought golf has done enough to grow the game within their younger audience, whether it's promotion of the game or if he was a fan of sort of the newer elements like Top Golf and Foot Golf to try and get a younger, more invested in golf from an earlier stage. Do you think golf has done enough to really grow it from a younger audience?
I think it does enough. I mean, I think, you know, I think that the idea that you go spend 4 hours on a golf course is not something that is going to appeal to somebody that's young, especially as, you know, as kind of society moves into a little bit of a quicker pace. I love the idea of going out and play nine holes. I love what Top Golf's done. I mean, I'm a big fan of Top Golf and have been for a while. You know, I just think it takes time. I mean, I think it takes time, not just from people telling you you're supposed to like golf. I think it takes time from teachers and parents and instructors to go out and show them that golf is fun. My buddy Joel Klatt, you know, who does a great job at college football for Fox,
yeah,
he was telling me that he takes his son out now, and his son's been really into it lately. I mean, Joel is a huge golf fan, and he's a golf nut, really, if you think about it. And he takes his son out, and a couple things he does on the golf course is he'll go up to a lake, drop a couple of balls, and let his son hit balls in the water, and then he'll hit a couple of balls in the water, and they laugh at it. You know, it's not saying don't hit it here. You know, he's showing him that the golf course can be a fun place. And he said his son's really, really attached himself to it. So I think in a way, I mean, you know, to get somebody interested in the game, you've got to make it a personal commitment yourself. And you've got to go out there and show them that it's not stodgy 4 hours, you know, because, I mean, if you just present that to a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old, how could they be that excited about it? 4 hours doing the same thing over and over again, probably not going to be that much fun. But if you go out there for 30 minutes here and 40 minutes here and just, you know, give them a little taste of it, you know, maybe they'll attach themselves to it. And if they don't, that's fine too. I mean, there's plenty of other things out there they can do. And I think we see that with all the sports, but I think maybe don't show them the entire pizza yet. You know, give them like maybe like a slice or even just a topping, and just maybe they'll want another slice. And if they do, then you can get them in.
It's sort of a good analogy for your career in golf, because you even mentioned on your site that if there's a job in golf that you've probably done it and you handle it and accomplish it from all these different angles. You started off on the writing side, on the journalism side of golf, turned into the podcast, working for AOL and Yahoo and CBS, and now working as a broadcaster for Fox, covering the U.S. Open. Do you sort of pinch yourself at all and think about this journey from how many different elements of the sport of golf you've been able to cover to sort of where you are now?
Yes, I pinch myself all the time. I trust me. Before I did this podcast, I'm sitting there, you know, eating lunch. You know, I mean, it is a very surreal experience every time I get here. I just walked up to the booth. There's two booths this year. So Joe Buck and Paul Azinger are going to have one, and then Brad Faxon and myself are going to have the other, and we're going to kind of like team up on the U.S. Open coverage. And about an hour and a half ago or something, I drove up and saw our position up there, right kind of by the putting green and looking out at the iconic Shinnecock Hills clubhouse there. And I mean, it was a moment. I mean, I had a moment. You know, there are moments in your life that you probably will never forget. And I mean, I was up there looking out at that. And I mean, you know, on Thursday, I'm going to be, you know, calling golf for the U.S. Open. I mean, it is a surreal thing to be a part of. It is still crazy to me that, you know, I'm going to get to do it. I mean, I always wanted to be a broadcaster. You know, I always wanted to be a sports broadcaster my entire life since I was like 10 years old. And, you know, I still can't believe that I actually get to do it. So yeah, it's a special week. I'm really fired up for it. I'm prepared. I'm excited. You know, Ryan Wilson at Fan House asking him if he'd let me write some, you know, guest golf blogs for $15 an article. I mean, yes, it's from there to here. It was a journey. And I mean, you know, it was a fun one. I mean, I got a chance to do some really, really cool stuff. You know, through Fan House and through CBS and through Devil Ball with Jay Busby at Yahoo. And, I remember my first audition. I went to Golf Channel and did this audition, and I was terrible at TV. Oh my God. It was the worst thing you'll ever, if they put tape out there, I'd probably get fired from this job. And, you know, thinking about those types of things and where it's kind of brought it to, you know, I mean, some of the people I get to call friends, you know, on this broadcast team, the Joe Bucks and the Paul Azingers and the Brad Faxons, it is a very, it's an honor, and it's something that I hold close to my heart. You know, it's not just a job for me. It's something I've been really passionate about. So, you know, it's a pretty exciting week for me, and I cannot wait till Thursday to get going.
Do you remember the most surprising thing you learned in your transition from the writing side to the television side? Something that you picked up along the way that you went, man, I didn't think it was going to be like this.
I'll tell you this. I didn't realize there'd be so much writing in it. I mean, that is, you know, I went to school, Stuart Scott, the late Stuart Scott. I got a tip from him through his grandmother one time when I was in high school to learn how to write if you want to do TV. And I thought that was really weird. Never really understood that.
That's great advice.
I was like, I want to do TV. And I went to school for writing. I went for print journalism, and I wrote all 4 years for the student newspaper, University of Arizona. And, you know, I thought I was going to be a writer. That's what I thought I was going to do. And doing TV is so much of your own words if you can do it. And so, I mean, you know, those things have echoed true throughout almost everything I've done through TV is, you know, being able to put stuff in your own words and write it down and use it. I mean, I've written down two or three things already this week that just in case it happens, I'll have it there for it. And, you know, so that's something that I think was something I was told before I even, you know, thought about doing any of this stuff for a career. And it's something that I use every single day. So I'd say that was probably the most surprising is the writing aspect that goes into the TV, because you just think you look at a sport and talk about it. And there is so much more to it. I'll tell you this too. Everybody always told me that there'd be a moment where somebody's talking in your ear and you'd kind of stop hearing them. It would just kind of be in the back of your head. And it took me a long time for that to happen, but it finally did happen. You know, you finally do, you're talking and you're kind of hearing them in the back of your head. And then, you know, you're getting the information you need, and then you can kind of spit it out on the back end of what you're saying. But it took a little bit of time. I think the first couple of times I answered the producer, you know, he's talking in my ear and I'm answering the producer on air to stop saying that. I was like, I don't know what to do. You know, so kind of, but you know, there's plenty of things that I've learned in that sense, but I would say probably the thing that I've used the most is the writing side of it.
I like that answer too, because it sounds like sort of in that process of learning how you write and learning your voice, that sort of figuring out your own voice in television. I was in radio for 7+ years and sort of trying to figure that out over the course of time, trying to understand that it's your voice, not somebody else's. That's something that I think once you sort of get in control of that, and so many other broadcasters on this podcast have said, it took me so long to figure out what I sound like, not what I thought I was supposed to sound like. That once you finally hit that stage, you're in so much more control of where the broadcast goes.
Exactly. And I mean, you listen to these guys that are unbelievable at it, you know, like the Joe Bucks and the Jim Nances and these people that just do it and it's flawless. And, you know, you might take a little bit of this or a little bit of that, but at the end of the day, it is you and you want to make it your own. But I'll tell you this, it's very easy to kind of fall into that, you know, and I almost find myself sometimes you'll fall into the analyst. You know, if you have Brad Faxon, there's one way to kind of approach it. If you have Zinger, it's another way. And, you know, if Curtis is up there, it's one way, or if it's Julie Inkster. So, yeah, I mean, I think it takes a little bit of time to just feel like it's you doing it and actually being confident in the fact that, you know, they're trusting the fact that you can do it. So go ahead and do it your own way.
You had mentioned earlier in the podcast that you were out and you got a chance to watch Rory and John Rahm be able to get themselves going in the early part of the week. I'm curious to get your perspective on the course itself. Is Shinnecock Hills a course that you expect to be immensely challenging to these golfers? Do you expect maybe single digit scores after four rounds, or are the conditions for this week set for some of these guys to, I guess, for lack of a better phrasing, be able to just tee off and go?
Yeah, it's going to be, you know, it's challenging. It's a very challenging golf course, and it always has been, you know, historically for US Open. The fairways are a little bit wider this time than they were in 04 and 95. And if you go back to 86, it's a wider looking Shinnecock Hills because they took the design back to what it used to look like. That being said, I have never seen rough like this in my life. If you hit it in the rough, I mean, it is going to be a pitch out almost every single time. I think with the wind kind of consistently blowing 15 miles an hour or so like it was today, I think 3, 4, 5 under, something like that will probably going to be in the winning score. I don't think it's going to be anything crazy. It's just the golf course. I mean, even with the spring they had here that was a little bit wetter and the golf course not being absolutely as firm as they want it to be, it's still going to be a mighty test for these guys. And if with a little bit of wind, like there was kind of a weirder wind today here. It was actually coming out of the southeast, which is not normal here. I think it's going to play tough for these guys. I mean, if you go out and shoot, you know, 3, 4, 5 under par here, you played an unbelievable round of golf. And I don't think you're going to see, nobody's going to run out and shoot 12 under for 4 days. I don't think so.
When we get into the field, it's nice to have some, you know, real tangible confidence in Tiger Woods going to a major. I think there was more intrigue.
You're telling me.
Right. I mean, I think for the Masters, there was probably more intrigue than confidence at Augusta. And, you know, as he's played on, he's gotten more and more casual fans, I think at least believing that maybe this is the comeback that we've been waiting for. And it's still remarkable to think that he hasn't won a major championship since Barack Obama was in office. That was in 2008. So for, you know, right now he's 16-1 to win the U.S. Open. I think he's seventh on the list of favorites as you go down the odds list. Are you buying in on Tiger? Do you think that this is finally, even in a condition course where the roughs are as bad as they are? I know that the fairways are wide, but Tiger's always had the power game to him. Does this course set up well for Tiger over the next week or so?
I think absolutely. I really do. I mean, I think the fact that the fairways are a little bit wider helps them. I don't think you're going to see the guys hitting drivers all day here. I think it's going to be a more position style golf course. You know, they'll hit. I talked to Will Zalatoris. He was on the tee at 18 today, young professional. And I said, how many drivers are you hitting here? And he said six around, you know. So, you know, that's not a lot. I mean, six drivers and that's it. So in a weird way, Tiger's had an underrated season on the PGA Tour. If you look statistically at what he's done in 2018, he's actually way up in the top five and top six in a lot of categories that you want to be. And it's almost surprising he doesn't have a win yet. So I absolutely think he's going to have a chance this week. I think of all the U.S. Open venues, Shinnecock Hills is one that really fits his current game really well. He can hit a lot of two irons. He can hit a lot of three woods. If he gets the ball off the tee in play, he can lean on the iron game that's been one of the best on the PGA Tour statistically this season. And he's been really, really good around the greens, too, if you look, he's top 10 in strokes gained around the greens. So I think we're going to see Tiger get himself in contention. I mean, you know, do I think he's going to win? I mean, that's hard to say, but I think he'll be in contention. I think he'll be in the top 15 or so going into the weekend just because the conditions of this golf course and the way it's going to play, they actually help with some of the things Tiger struggled at. And so, you know, the greens are in great shape. And he's been struggling a little bit with his putting the last few weeks. So you know, if he's not making those five footers, I mean, if anybody's missed five footers, they're not going to have a chance. But, you know, if he putts like he did earlier in the season and he gets the ball in play, I think he's going to have a really good chance of playing well. And, you know, we're excited about it. We haven't had a U.S. Open really with Tiger at all since Fox has taken over the U.S. Open coverage. So, you know, this is the first time we're really getting to see him in form where you'd actually say, yes, I think Tiger has a chance. So, I mean, it's, you can feel the buzz around here. I mean, it's not just Tiger, trust me, but it definitely feels like a bigger U.S. Open this year than ones we've had in the past. And I think it's a mixture of a great venue, not a lot of other sports going on. You know, NBA Finals done, Stanley Cup's done, baseball's in June. You know, there's not a lot else going on. I think people are really, really fired up about this week.
I think you're right. I think just the build-up to the U.S. Open, I think for the first time in a long time, knowing that Tiger was going to be a major part of it, was going to be a key part of the conversation. How much of that has been discussed for you guys in pre-production meetings? I know it's the beginning of the week, but I guess there has to be sort of a scenario for whether or not Tiger is in play on the back end of Saturday and Sunday versus if he gets cut, and then all of a sudden a lot of the narrative completely changes.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, one of our commitments here is that we show golf, and we show a lot of live golf. And, you know, if Tiger's in contention, we're going to show a lot of Tiger golf shots. If he's not in contention, you know, we'll show him occasionally, I think. But we're going to stick to the guys that are up there near the top of the leaderboard, because that's the story of the U.S. Open. You know, who's going to win this? Who's going to take home the national championship? So, you know, I mean, I think everyone's excited for the possibility of Tiger being there. And I think, you know, you're going to see a lot of Tiger Woods, as you'd expect to see, especially in those first 2 days. I mean, you know, playing in that kind of number one world ranking grouping that he's in is pretty exciting. You know, I think that's a cool grouping to see him go out there with Justin Thomas and Dustin Johnson. And, you know, it's going to be one of our featured groups. It's going to be you're going to get to see a lot of Tiger if you want to. But, you know, we're going to show a lot of the other people, too. I mean, it's going to be a lot of Spieth and a lot of Phil. You know, I mean, Phil's kind of flying under the radar. I mean, he closes with 65 in Memphis. I mean, you never know what Phil Mickelson's going to do. But coming back to a place that he probably should have won at back in 2004, and, you know, he seems really excited about the setup. And I think for Phil, the mentality is a huge part of it. Coming into it thinking he has a chance, I think it's just as important as that he's playing well or making putts. So, you know, there's a lot of storylines coming in with some of these big names. And, I mean, I think we were only helped by Sunday with Dustin Johnson winning. You know, he won a couple of years ago at the U.S. Open, and I think he's going to have a great chance as well. It's just crazy how many players have done something this year already. And then you throw in Tiger and Phil, and you're like, man, this could be an unbelievably epic weekend.
I think that's a really interesting point, too. Like you mentioned that Dustin Johnson right now, he's the favorite at 9-1, Roy McIlroy right behind him at 11-1, and then it's Spieth and Justin Thomas and Jason Day and Justin Rose before Tiger and Fowler. And the familiar names are right up at the top. So before we let you go, I guess if you're looking for two final pairings down the stretch, maybe a couple favorites and a couple of maybe sleeper names towards the end, who do you think would be some of those really intriguing pairings down the stretch to make for a great finish to the U.S. Open?
So I was talking about this last week. You know, we did the U.S. Women's Open down in Birmingham, and then the week after we just finished up the Curtis Cup. So we've been on the road for 3 weeks. So we've talked a lot about Shinnecock Hills over dinners and drinks and stuff like that. So I think, in my opinion, the best final pairing is Tiger and Jordan Spieth. Everybody's going to say Tiger and Phil, and that's fine. But I think you throw Tiger, which is obviously, you know, the best player of his generation, and people could argue the best player ever. And then Jordan Spieth, who kind of has that ability to win big events, I think, more than anybody that's currently playing. You know, I just think when he gets himself there, he finds a way to win them. And then I think the follow-up pairing would be Phil and Rory to chase. And so, you know, I mean, I think a lot of people would love to see Tiger and Phil paired together. I like Phil chasing a little bit. I think Phil would have a lot of fun being kind of in that penultimate group alongside of Rory. And then, I mean, you know, the third group could be Ricky and Dustin. Or Justin and Dustin or Sergio, whoever you want to throw in there, that'd be fine with us. But, you know, if you could get something in that world thrown in there. And then if you were talking about some players that I like this week that I think would have a chance that maybe are off the radar a little bit, I like Patrick Cantlay a little bit. I think Tommy Fleetwood played really well at the U.S. Open last year, and he's getting more and more comfortable in the big stage on this American side of stuff. So, you know, he's kind of continued his great run that he had the last 18 months or so. I've had Ricky is my winner here for about a year, and I think I'm just going to stick with it. I think this golf course sets up really well for Ricky Fowler. You know, he hits his driver really straight when he's on, and he's one of the better putters from inside of 10 feet that you'll find. So, you know, those are the guys that I would kind of look at here is who I'm, you know, kind of circling. And I'll tell you this, you know, there are 22 amateurs in the field, and I think that's the most they've ever had. I'll know more after our meeting in about an hour, but I would not be surprised if this leaderboard ends on Sunday with an amateur in the top 10. I mean, there are so many of these young guys that have all the credits in the world to come out here and play well. And considering how many there are in this field, I could see an amateur going out there and shooting even one under for 4 days and being in that top five, top seven. I think there's so many of them that there's a chance you could see that. I think that'd be really cool. You know, this is a championship, and the USGA in itself loves amateur golf, and it's one of the coolest things they do is how much they embrace amateur golf. And I'd love to see just an amateur maybe in the third or fourth last pairing just to see it, because we haven't seen it in a while.
Certainly be a great way to finish out the U.S. Open. Shane, I appreciate your time. I'm excited for people to be able to hear you and watch you during Fox's and FS1's broadcast from the 2018 U.S. Open. Again, also check out his podcast as well, The Clubhouse. He's also on Twitter at Shane Bacon. Appreciate the time. Have a great time in New York. Say hi to my friend Joe Buck for me and look forward to catching up again soon.
Hey, anytime. I had the head pro from Shinnecock on the Clubhouse, and it just went up on Monday. So if you want a little bit more of an in-depth, nerdy golf dive into what you'll see this week, Jack was on, and he was great. So I appreciate you having on. It was a lot of fun, and anytime you want to catch back up, let me know.
My thanks to Shane Bacon for stopping by the Awful Announcing Podcast today. Looking forward to his coverage of the U.S. Open from Shinnecock Hills in New York. Coming up in a couple days, we got a really fun podcast planned for you guys. Another really special guest ahead of his upcoming television show. We will tell you who that is, but remember to follow us on Twitter at Awful Announcing for your chance to guess and consequently win $50 to Amazon.com. Thank you guys all for listening. This is Ben Heisler saying so long. We will talk to you again very soon right here on the Awful Announcing Podcast.